Long-Term Care Division to order. Welcome, members. We have a full agenda today. So I am entertaining a motion to approve the minutes from Monday, February 17th.
So move, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cantrell moves the minutes. All in favor? Or any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Minutes approved. Okay, next I need to make a re-referral of a bill so it goes to the correct committee. This is House File 3445, Representative Morrison's bill on psychiatric residential treatment facility services. So I will make a motion to re-refer House File 3445 to Health and Human Services Policy Committee without recommendation. Any discussion? No? All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, motion to re-refer approved. Excellent. So today we're going to hear two presentations and then two bills. So the first presentation, we're very fortunate to have Cheryl Hennen from the State Ombudsman for Long-Term Care Office. She's going to give us an update on the office and all the great things they're doing. So welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, I am Cheryl Hennen, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Most faces of the committee look familiar to me, some new. Thank you for your time today. And you should all have a copy of my presentation. And I'm going to begin my presentation by saying, let's begin with the end in mind. And the very last slide of this presentation is my name, my phone number, and my email address. And so I invite any of you to contact me. You may invite me to local community events, local forums, when you are speaking with people in your communities. And the topic of long-term care is something that is important, should be, to all of us. If you have one more day on this blessed earth, you too are aging. So my invitation is that you invite me out into your communities and we dialogue with your community members, your constituents, on the topic of long-term care. So with that, the first slide gives you the federal and state authority for our program. Every state must have a state long-term care ombudsman. I will not go through every word on that slide, but what I will emphasize is the Older Americans Act. The Older Americans Act authorizes state long-term care programs to protect the health, safety, welfare, and rights of some of our most vulnerable yet valuable citizens. The Administration for Community Living is the federal level department that serves as the advocate for older adults within the Department of Health and Human Services and authorizes the grants to states. Just to sort of set this up, every state must identify a state unit on aging. In Minnesota, that's the Minnesota Board on Aging. Our executive director is Carrie Benson in the audience. I want to call her out. And our federal money flows through the State Unit on Aging and is distributed to our office. The next slide, what we do. So without reading every word on this slide, you may need to refer back to it if you ever get the question. Primary: identify, investigate, and resolve resident complaints. Many years back, it was Congress intent. The reason why Ombudsman Office is one of the foundational reasons why we exist is because back in that time, the conditions in nursing homes were so deplorable that Congress committed to people who live in licensed facilities have the right access to an advocate that is confidential, well-trained, and will work to resolve their problems. It's a very difficult thing to bring up problems and concerns, and you want someone that you can come to that's well-trained. So I set that up for you because when you think about how did this all get started, that's a very brief history, but primary in our work is to identify, investigate, and resolve complaints. We provide a lot of information and consultation to people who call into the office. In fact, we run about 40 calls a day coming in live, a person answering those calls. Advocate for systemic change and work to inform public agencies and others about the problems that residents are facing. National and state issues. So as your state long-term care ombudsman for long-term care, I felt I would give you a brief of what's happening at the national level. What are our discussions about? The reauthorization of the Older Americans Act right now is prime. The 2016 Older Americans Act was reauthorized for fiscal year 2017 through fiscal year 2019. January 27, 2020, a bipartisan group of congressional staff released their proposed bill to reauthorize the Older Americans Act for an additional 5 years. Among other provisions, the bill proposes the increase appropriation, that there is an increase to the appropriation by 7% the first year and 6% subsequent years. There is so much more to this, but you will hear and may already hear. In fact, some of you may have more information than what I just said. Why are we talking about reauthorizing the Older Americans Act? This is why. Because the current authorization ends, and we hope to see that there will be success at the federal level in reauthorizing the Older Americans Act. What are the national policy issues that we are talking about? So I give you some of the top proper staffing levels. I'm sure that this is not something that is new to anyone that I'm speaking to today. Background studies. We really must work to make sure that there is a comprehensive, thorough background study completed on people who are working in long-term care facilities. Background studies, the way in which they are conducted, are not consistent around all states. Arbitration agreements. This policy issue is about a ban on enforcing arbitration agreements when somebody enters into a nursing home. Admission, transfer, discharge. Nationally, this is the most common complaint ombudsmen receive. This is not only about when someone is involuntarily discharged from a facility, but it also includes when an individual is transferred to a hospital and then may be refused admittance back to their home. Right now, Minnesota, myself, we are in the throes of having our federal report certified, which continues the flow of money. So, our report is sitting with the actual federal certifiers, and I have a long list of questions now that they are asking me to make sure that we have it all right. And I'm here to tell you I'm confident we will get this done and we will continue our flow of federal monies. But what's most important is I wanted to tell you, well, what is Minnesota seeing in their report, in their complaint work from last federal fiscal year? So you see this on your slide. The first, residents as complainants, highest ever as a total percent, 47% over. That is a very good thing. What that tells us is the residents are the complainants. It is not a bad thing that we are getting a lot of, we receive a lot of complaints from family members and loved ones and other people. But look what we are doing here in Minnesota. That is a wonderful thing. Residents are the ones as the complainants. Admission, transfer, discharge. So this is Minnesota, 10% increase over last year. It's right up there with the rest of the nation. Highest ever over year over year increase. Shortage of staff, complaints up, highest ever. Staff turnover, overuse of nursing pools. Staff turnover, use of, excuse me, that's a double, I apologize for that on the list. Staff unresponsive, unavailable complaints up highest ever. So how are these titles arrived on? These come from what the this is what the federal government asks us to report on, so we don't make up these titles. But what you see is reflective around the country as well in terms of staff shortage, staff turnover, and the staff unavailable certainly could be a byproduct of not enough staff. I also want to talk about, well, not just the problems, what are we doing about it? What are the collaborative efforts? Well, certainly the legislative success and our role as a critical partner to passing the Elder Care and Vulnerable Adult Protection Act. Assisted living rulemaking process, we are involved in many of the stakeholder meetings, and I write for you as of August 1, what will really happen in Minnesota. This just gives you a very brief overview. I also want to let you know about the work we are doing on elder sexual abuse. Sexual abuse in long-term care facilities is a nationwide problem. That has, of course, received media attention in the past few years. Unfortunately, this topic has also appeared on Minnesota media attention. And what I'm proud to let you know about is a collaborative effort in Minnesota, which includes the provider organizations, the Ombudsman's Office, the Department of Human Services, and other community members, where we actually are utilizing civil monetary penalty monies. We've hired a professional videographer and others to put together a training for nursing home staff on sexual abuse. And this training will focus on preventing, identifying, and responding properly. We have law enforcement, we have county attorneys, we have many different disciplines that will be on this video training. And I would suggest that this committee might want to even see a snippet of that. I'm very proud of it where it is thus far, to be released hopefully by the end of this year. We also have received Money Follows the Person, or working in collaboration with Moving Home Minnesota, on a self-empowerment project, which is training, a curriculum training for resident councils. It's very difficult for people to come forward and voice their opinion or talk about complaints when they're the resident. So this training actually helps empower people to feel that it's okay to speak up. We have provided this training to over 1,000 residents around the state of Minnesota over the last year. There's so much more that we are doing, but I'm also very aware that don't just talk about the problems, talk about some possible solutions. The Elder Care and Vulnerable Adult Protection Act, I point out for you on this slide some of the main areas that many people in this room work together, and I thank the legislature for the support of passing the bill. Also, I cannot thank you enough for the budget appropriation to this office. I will tell you, I wasted no time in order to hire staff and get the job done. That's what you wanted me to do. That's what you supported me to do. It's a lot of work, but we are doing it. And you know, within the new legislation, as of January 1, 2020, there is now the electronic monitoring law, which enshrines in law that a camera can be placed. And I wanted to report to you there, within the budget appropriation, you allowed for one FTE. I hired that one FTE. The person did move on and went with very good impressions of the office, and so the job is posted, and I guarantee you it will be, well, within my control. The person will be on staff within another month. But I wanted to give you a sense of, well, what have you been doing then since that law took place? We've been working collaboratively with the Minnesota Department of Health and other stakeholders in the development of forms. If you go to the Minnesota Department of Health website today, you will find that there are consent forms available on the website. And We also, you know that within the provision of law, there exists the opportunity to exercise a right to an exemption period of 14 days should someone fear retaliation. There is the opportunity for someone to exercise their right to not informing the facility for 14 days. So if you back up, if we want to put a camera in our room, there is a consent form that you must fill out and give to the provider. If you fear retaliation, you may exercise this 14-day exemption and you submit the form to the ombudsman's office. So what do we do when we receive it? So I can tell you that as of today, we have received 5 consent forms to exercise the right to the 14-day exemption period. Part of that, I think, is people just getting used to this new law and understanding what their rights are. I have 5, but yet actually it was only 4 residents utilizing that 14-day period because one of them was a facility that thought all their forms should come to us, but we clarified that for them. We are receiving many questions about this new law, and we are responding to them favorably, not only from the public, but also from providers. Everything from, I found a camera, now what do I do? To, I don't want this camera in my room, now what do I do? So we are fielding many questions and able to respond to them effectively. Staff increase. So the staffing increase slide, this explains what you actually authorized for the office, the 17 FTEs, which included 9 regional ombudsmen to serve residents throughout Minnesota, 1 deputy ombudsman, 1 electronic monitoring staff, and 6 additional staff positions. So I've already explained about the electronic monitoring position. We also now have 1 additional deputy, which means they provide supervision to the regional staff as well as other duties. So former map, if we move to the maps, when I testified before you last session, this is what we told you. So the national average of regional ombudsman is defined by 1 FTE to 2,000 active beds. At the time I sat before you last year, it was 1 to 9,000. So that's what the map looked like. Today, this is what it looks like now. We've hired to the extent where we reduced that 1 RO per 6,300 active beds. And we did this based on need. So it wasn't like I just haphazardly threw a dart at the map. We paid very close attention to where we have a great need going on right now. So this also shows you, I want you to see what my staffing plan looks like in order to accommodate the total regional staff in the end. So if you toggle between, you'll notice that the proposed staffing plan actually breaks up some of those bigger parts of the state to better provide a presence. And again, once we are finished with the staffing proposed plan, we will reduce that ratio to 1 to 5,040 beds. Not quite 1 to 2,000, but it's a huge improvement. I also I carved out the metro for you. So again, last year when I sat before you, here's what I presented, and here's what we have today. Of course, as you know, the population is quite dense in the metro. So we have made great improvement, and I very much thank you for your support of the program.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. Do we have any questions for the testifier?
No questions.
No questions. Well, thank you so much for working on this. I'm glad we were able to fund more positions and hopefully that will translate into better service in servicing older adults. So thank you so much, Cheryl. We look forward to hearing progress throughout the year.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next up we have Daryl Foss, the chair of the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group, to report on Alzheimer's Disease Working Group report. And Beth McMullen is joining us. Daryl, thank you. Introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Daryl Foss, and it was my honor to serve as a chair for the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group. Our focus for this work was to identify actions necessary to address the needs of almost 100,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, and to prepare the state for an even larger wave of Minnesotans who will be impacted by dementia in the coming years. Each recommendation we have included plays an integral part in changing the future for so many Minnesotans. Your actions will have a powerful impact on the lives of thousands of people living with Alzheimer's disease and Alzheimer's and other dementias, while ultimately reducing the cost that these diseases to our state. It is a goal worthy of your efforts. I was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment in June of 2015. Since that time, I have been actively involved in dementia advocacy and a number of research projects conducted by organizations across Minnesota. With some accommodations, I am living well with the disease. Other Minnesotans with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias don't have as positive a story to share. Minnesota can and must do more to change their life stories. We are extremely proud of the work we have done in preparing this report. For 10 months, over 75 Minnesotans were involved on the working group and its five supporting committees to update the 2011 report, Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's, the budgetary, social, and personal impacts. Whether our perspective was as a care partner, caregiver, researcher, clinician, professional care provider, or a person living with the disease, we came together and shared our stories, expert knowledge, and hopes. The working group tackled the challenges of distilling all that was discussed into the most important and specific actions the state can take to respond to the full impact of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. The next important steps are up to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foss. Let's see. Cheryl Hennen, I believe you're next on the list. So please introduce yourself again for the record and then proceed.
I'm Cheryl Hennen, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk about the wonderful work of the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group. The Alzheimer's Disease Working Group greatly appreciates the time, effort, and expertise of all community members who participated in the recommendations and report development. Our working group also thanks the Minnesota Board on Aging and its staff for handling our group logistics and management analysis and development for meeting facilitation and report writing. Let me spend just a moment to talk about what Alzheimer's and dementia are. Alzheimer's disease is more than just memory loss. It's a progressive disease of the brain that destroys brain cells, causing problems with memory, thinking, and behavior. Dementia is a general term used to describe a decline in cognitive functioning, and Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. So in referring to the slide, there are three stages of Alzheimer's: preclinical, mild cognitive impairment, and dementia due to Alzheimer's. Preclinical. The disease may be present for decades before any symptoms appear. Mild cognitive impairment. Small changes in memory and thinking abilities occur, but do not compromise independence. And then finally, dementia due to Alzheimer's. When Alzheimer's disease and other dementias begin to rob individuals of their abilities, their need for care and acceptance increases. At the same time, the abilities of their former informal network of caregivers are stretched, often adding to the suffering of the individual's family unit. Eventually, families look for various support services that can ease the burden and keep individuals diagnosed safe and otherwise healthy in their own homes. And often the need progresses to the point where residential institutions often become necessary for the sake of everyone involved. I understand that you have a fact sheet from the Alzheimer's Association in your packet for more information. The facts and statistics on Alzheimer's disease are concerning. However, real life stories bring the crisis to life. I am so proud of the fact of how much this report reflects actual real life stories. Family members, caregivers were intricately involved in this report. And the report reflects these actual stories. And I want to thank the members who did share their personal stories, which isn't always an easy thing to do. It's a very difficult walk at times and journey for people. But their stories provide hope and support for others affected by the disease. And they also inspire action by those not directly affected by Alzheimer's disease by personalizing the disease and building awareness around its impact. The bottom line is Minnesota is still not fully prepared to address the impact of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias on Minnesotans. Many previous efforts to prepare the state, while well-intentioned and successful in their own right, have been fragmented. Similar to the 2011 working group, the 2018 working group believes Minnesota needs a much stronger and comprehensive statement on Alzheimer's disease. So you see on this slide, that's the actual cover of the 2011 report. Our working group looked closely at this report, and we're happy to report to you of the positive action from those initial recommendations. One powerful initiative that emerged from the 2011 Alzheimer's Disease Working Group was Act on Alzheimer's. Many of you may know of this, a public-private Minnesota-based collaboration. While the original initiative has concluded its work, other organizations continue the work of Act on Alzheimer's within their communities. Also, the legislature responded to that report by providing annual Alzheimer's research grants and a competitive grants program that focuses on dementia and its impact on persons with dementia, family and friend caregivers of persons with dementia. While the state has seen progress in many ways, some of the 2011 report's suggested areas of improvement have seen less progress and still needed work. Minnesota does not have a coordinated public awareness campaign, which leads to gaps in the consistency and clarity of information provided to Minnesota communities. While gold standards for care have been identified, the inconsistent use of these recommendations result in quality of care that varies widely across residential settings. Gaps remain in access to culturally sensitive information and culturally responsive healthcare providers. There are two overarching recommendations contained in our report. As a state, we must be clear on who or what agency should be responsible and accountable to these recommendations and monitoring the impact of dementia in Minnesota. If there is one consensus among many great that happened in the work of this committee, is we do not want this report to go on the shelf and collect dust. We are committed to seeing action. So that's first. We must be clear on who or what agency is responsible. And second, we must prioritize and invest in the development of the state's healthcare workforce. Our working group organized the specific recommendations in the report around the five stories that I mentioned earlier. Each story relates to a broader area of concern and what we believe the state should do to positively influence those concerns. The five stories are listed here, and our next presenters will talk about each one specifically. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. So do we have Edward Ratner?
Yes. Hello.
Introduce yourself, yes. And then proceed.
I'm Dr. Edward Ratner. I'm a physician who specializes in geriatric medicine. I teach and do research and practice clinically at the University of Minnesota and the VA Medical Center here in Minneapolis. Thank you very much for inviting us, Madam Chair and committee members. The first story I want to read very quickly is from a caregiver that stated, "The Minnesota legislature needs to realize that there are different types of dementia, and their emphasis on person-centered care is most important. Each person deserves to have the most specific individual care plan because all of us are unique and special." One of the first problems that was mentioned by the previous speaker is that our dementia-related data collection is currently minimal, especially compared to many other diseases such as diabetes and cancer. Since dementia care goes beyond the healthcare system, data collection should include characteristics of the geographic and ethnic communities in which people with dementia live. Therefore, the task force recommends that dementia care should be part of the state's larger strategic plan for health and aging services, that the state should designate an entity within the state government to continually monitor the state's progress on implementing the working group recommendations, to end the reliance on intermittent external work group reviews, that the Departments of Health and Human Service should better coordinate efforts to improve the quality and availability of dementia-related data, and that the Minnesota Department of Health should obtain data from the Minnesota-based healthcare systems regarding dementia, so the department can help them develop and implement programs and policies that improve care and foster a nurturing, supportive environment for people with dementia and their caregivers. Our vision is that all Minnesotans benefit from a medical care community that is prepared, educated, and supported to diagnose, treat, and care for people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias and their caregivers. Dementia care requires many professionals besides physicians. Minnesota must promote workforce development in a variety of fields related to aging, with recognition of the need for capacity to address cultural and native language diversity. The vast majority of healthcare professional training occurs in hospitals and clinics, while dementia care occurs primarily in nursing homes, assisted livings, adult day service providers, and home health agencies. Therefore, the task force recommends that the Minnesota legislature should revise Minnesota statutes to remove the exclusion of nursing homes from receiving medical education and research costs grants. The nursing home setting is the only healthcare setting that is excluded from such grants. In addition, the task force recognizes that the Minnesota State Veterans Homes offer an ideal very underutilized setting for training health professionals in dementia care. Therefore, the task force recommends that the Minnesota Department of Veterans State Veterans Homes should partner with higher education institutions and other government organizations to help create a workforce across many professions that is prepared to provide long-term care services, including dementia care. Next slide goes back to the issue of data. We collect data on a variety of healthcare issues, but have neglected the common condition of Alzheimer's disease. The task force recommends that the state should prioritize and incentivize outcome reporting on Alzheimer's disease by medical providers. Outcomes that should be reported include, but aren't limited to, the numbers of screenings and assessments, the number of people diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, and the number and types of referrals to other resources. Like the current opioid crisis, Alzheimer's disease is going to soon overwhelm our existing expertise if it hasn't already. The task force recommends required training on cognitive impairment through healthcare licensing boards, such as now mandated for physicians related to opioids and social workers regarding ethics. Finally, the task force recommends that state agencies and boards responsible for public health, such as the Department of Health and the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice, should promote and share the routine use of Act on Alzheimer's practice guidelines for the detection and management of cognitive impairment and dementia in primary and specialty care within all Minnesota health systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ratner. Well, we do have a bill that is being sponsored by Representative Mason. It's House File 3557 that will allow Merck funding for nursing homes for training. So
it can happen.
A person came up to me at the long-term care forum. Is that you, Ed?
Yes.
Okay. And so the bill has been dropped, so it's House File 3557. So if you can
I'll
help champion that bill, that would be great.
Okay.
So it's Representative Mason is carrying the bill. It's House File 3557, and it provides Merck funding for training in nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities. Okay, any other questions? I want to pause. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for your presentation. I think almost every family's been affected by this one way or another. My father-in-law had Alzheimer's for 12 years before he passed away, so... Mm-hmm. A very long and difficult time. But, you know, we were down this summer for a mini session down by Rochester, and they had spoke about restorative medicine. You know, this is cutting edge research. Is there any part as far as Alzheimer's or dementia that would apply to this type of research down in that's taking place down in Rochester?
Dr. Ratner.
Yeah, so I'm not an expert on all the research related to Alzheimer's, but I do know that it's been a very long and frustrating process to find any treatments that slow the progression, and been involved in several reviews of the entire literature on Alzheimer's disease that were funded to the University of Minnesota, looking at what can we do to prevent or treat Alzheimer's disease. And from a medication standpoint, I'd say there's we're still not there yet in terms of anything that's kind of approved or even close to being approved. On the other hand, the idea of how to improve the quality of life of people with cognitive disorders and Alzheimer's disease is well known, and a variety of guidelines and approaches exist. And in the sense of restorative, there's clearly ways that rehabilitation therapists can work with both people with cognitive disorders and their caregivers to improve communication and function and help maintain the ability to do things independent of measures of cognition directly.
Okay. We have one more presenter, Heidi Haley Franklin. Would you like to introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Haley Franklin, and I'm the Vice President of Programs at the Alzheimer's Association. And the next recommendation from the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group report is that all homes are safe homes. And when we think about home, we think that the home should be a place of safety, especially when people feel the most vulnerable. As Alzheimer's or another dementia progresses, families eventually look for various support services that can ease the care burden of caring for the person with dementia. Keeping individuals who are diagnosed safe and otherwise healthy in their homes becomes difficult in many cases, and the need progresses to a point where residential institutions often become necessary for the sake of everybody involved. I won't spend significant time on the recommendations related to this storyline because instead I want to thank the legislature and governor for passing the landmark assisted living licensure bill last session, which addressed a number of our recommendations. The bill passed last year, improved resident rights, and established a license framework. While that bill also addressed dementia care standards in the new license framework, it did not address skilled nursing facilities or home care. So we may be back in the future to address those settings. One issue in this category that was not a part of the discussion last session is adopting a Minnesota Family and Medical Leave Act that includes parent-in-law in the definition of family members for which an employee can take unpaid leave. As a reminder, Alzheimer's disease is a chronic condition that can last more than a decade. And during each stage, people living with the disease, their family, and their caregivers, and medical professionals all have unique needs. On this slide, you'll see that a family member of someone living with dementia stated, "We would like the legislature to know that dementia is a personal issue as well as a societal issue. People who have dementia should feel like they are a part of the community and not feel like they have to hide because they are experiencing symptoms of dementia, such as memory loss." Which brings us to our fourth recommendation that I'll share with you, and that is people are supported every step of the way. The Minnesota Board on Aging should reevaluate the long-term care counseling process and the information provided through Senior Linkage Line. They should consider providing information in more consumer-friendly formats that support patient and family decision-making throughout the care continuum. The Minnesota Department of Health should reform health systems in Minnesota by promoting early detection and diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And they should also incentivize the treatment of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias as a chronic disease by keeping an up-to-date authoritative link on its website. The state should also actively support creative regional efforts to establish community dementia resource centers that work in partnership with each region's medical community to create a better web of support for each resident needing services. This should include coordination with tribal nations and American Indian communities. While the disease itself cannot be prevented, Minnesotans impacted by Alzheimer's and other dementias face additional significant and preventable risks such as financial exploitation and consumer fraud. To protect and keep everyone safe, Minnesota needs to increase awareness of the disease, reduce stigma, and develop standards and guidance regarding safety issues, which can help mitigate some of the non-medical risks. However, clear standards and guidelines can help create a safe space within which to have these conversations. They can allow people living with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias and their caregivers to feel more in control and live more independently. As the legislature considers how to mitigate risks, members should consider the needs of families and caregivers who may have different cultural norms and values related to Alzheimer's disease and dementias. And the fifth and final recommendation is people can live well or maximize their quality of life with dementia. Because of this, the Minnesota legislature should support a collaboratively led, coordinated, and statewide awareness campaign on Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. This campaign should help reduce stigma, offer a balanced perspective of risks and treatment possibilities, and share how people adapt to and maximize their quality of life with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or other dementia. Relevant state agencies should convene a group of dementia experts, dementia clinicians, and other pertinent community stakeholders to develop standards around risks and safety related to Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. They should also recommend an implementation strategy for these standards that could include the dissemination through Act on Alzheimer's practice guidelines, continuing medical education standards, or other regulatory or statutory changes. That concludes our prepared comments, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do we have questions from members? Representative Mason?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're all aware of the ramifications of families that have somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia, but the fact that you're mentioning the stigma attached to that is appalling. And so maybe, you know, if you can give some examples of how we can deal with that or some of the problems of the families that feel that there is a stigma. I guess I haven't come across that so much as just the difficulty in addressing the situation. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, there's a great amount of stigma that exists, and I feel like it is getting a little bit better with families coming forward and individuals coming forward and sharing their stories. But a lot of times people, when they receive a diagnosis or even suspect a diagnosis, they don't want to tell their family and friends because they're embarrassed of the changes that they're experiencing. And so one way that the Alzheimer's Association and the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group talked about in trying to reduce the stigma is the awareness campaign. And talking more about Alzheimer's disease and various dementias and having it be much more in a public space can really help move the needle forward in helping people feel empowered to talk about their diagnosis.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have other public testifiers in the audience?
My name's
you want to come to the table, please?
Great question. I'm going to answer that one as a family member.
Sure.
Any microphone?
You want to come to the front table and take a seat there and then state your name, please, for the record?
My name's Dan Kreiser. I'm from Apple Valley. Unfortunately, my family has been more than touched. It's been crushed. I'm 61. I have four siblings that have early onset Alzheimer's. My father passed away. We have a very rare form of Alzheimer's. It's genetic. So I want to be really specific here. 1% of the people with Alzheimer's have, unfortunately, my kind. I'm negative. They can look at my DNA. To your question, the stigma, and to your, he disappeared, about research and medicine. My family just finished part of a 4-year study. And the stigma that goes with it is we were gonna be in an Associated Press article, but because of the genetic nature of this disease, future generations, as well as my brother who's still working and not affected, we don't wanna go in the press and say we've got it. Because there's financial implications, there's career implications. One of my nieces said, hey, I'm still dating. You know, I don't want to put a big hex on my dating career. So as a family member, the stigma is very real. And part of that is you can't get long-term care insurance. There's a whole bunch of implications. Potentially. I don't care what the law says that you can't hold genetics against a person. That's the rule today. Whether they do or don't, they can still ask the question when you go to get insurance. So, and I'll just say one other thing is the caregivers in this, we talk about the disease, and unfortunately you're out of the room, but there's been 300 human studies with medications. Zero have proven safe and effective. Zero. The study we were in just completed earlier this month, and unfortunately, we successfully answered the question. Unfortunately, the answer was no, it didn't help. So the struggle continues. Think more about how do we handle the collateral damage of the family and the caregivers. Because that blast radius affects all of us in the community. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So I think it's a good point that the testifier just made, because if the ACA is repealed, the pre-existing condition clause will be eliminated, and if you have a genetic test, that could hurt you to get affordable health insurance coverage in the future and other coverage like long-term care insurance. Go ahead, Dr.
If I could just add another approach that the state can take in terms of reducing stigma, in terms of a long-term investment, is thinking about how our K through 12 education system can provide education, and kids take their knowledge home and explain it to their parents. And given that every school child is likely to have a grandparent or an aunt or uncle or a great grandparent with this condition, know somebody, it's understanding how we could reduce the stigma by improving the general population understanding.
Like, we have one more testifier.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee. I head Children's Hope International, which does legal advocacy and public policy. Our shelters are under R&R Family Centers, which is housing and services and health care. I also head a housing consortium group. Some of you have received attached handout, and if you didn't, could certainly send it by email. Basically, I wanted to talk about the situation that exists as a person is becoming or developing dementia and Alzheimer, where they are victims of fraud, abuse, and financial exploitation, so that by the time they get into the nursing home stage where they need that help, all their assets are gone. And there's a need to protect it, and the laws aren't strong enough as far as intervening in circumstances and helping them save their money. They only talk about financial exploitation when it occurs in a nursing home or other facilities, but not beforehand and by anybody else. So there's a need in that area. Towards the end, I have solutions to which includes expanding statute 45A.01, 609.232, 609.2325, and 609.2335. And also, as far as the need for them to age in place and to connect with the appropriate agencies to help them overcome the barriers that prevent them from aging in place. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Okay, Representative Cleavorn, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, as I was listening to the testifiers today, I'm thinking about all of the ramifications, and to the point of stigma. It's more than stigma, and I would like to know if the Alzheimer's Working Group has looked at things like wrongful termination, you know, for people who've been terminated from their employment for the inability to do their job, but it is actually later discovered to be health related in this manner with Alzheimer's. Or also, as we go forward and people do receive more and more genetic tests as a routine, could they be subject to early dismissal from their employment, even though symptoms haven't manifest yet, or professions like medicine, law, terminal degrees, where employment liability insurance would maybe say, I know you're not presenting, but you've now become a liability, and we need you to step down from your position, let's say, at the university or at the VA?
Who would like to answer that question? Beth McMullen, go ahead, Beth.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth McMullen. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you very much for hearing these recommendations and for your very thoughtful questions today. The working group itself did not explore work discrimination type issues in their work in this last round. And my understanding is that in the original in 2011, they did not either. So it's certainly an area, I think, that is worthy of exploration as we get better at detecting and diagnosing this disease earlier and earlier to understand the ramifications of that. I would say the Alzheimer's Association is very careful when we talk about genetic testing for Alzheimer's and other dementia, that it a genetic test may tell you that you have a gene, but you may never develop symptoms. You may not have the gene, and you may still develop symptoms. So this is a very complicated conversation around genetics, and that it should be a conversation that you have very specifically with your medical provider. But the working group itself did not explore this topic.
Connecting it back to the previous discussion about stigma, if a person in a workplace is recognizing that they have some cognitive difficulties, can't learn the new computer system, and their physician might tell them you're showing signs, that the public stigma associated with that is likely to make a person unlikely to tell their employer, the same way that they would have a repetitive stress injury and go and say, gee, I need a new mouse or a new desk because my back hurts. And so I think if we can reduce the stigma and say, this is just a condition and it's a long term from the point at which you're having some difficulty and can't do everything at work to when you might not be able to work at all. And as the population ages and our workforce ages, we need to figure out ways to accommodate people who can't walk as far or lift as much, as well as can't learn things as quickly.
Okay, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't going to say anything, but I your comment spurred the working issue. We need to really encourage people, though, to say something to their family, go to the doctor and ask. My mother-in-law came to me, and she's deceased now, and she finally said to me, she said, I can't write the words right. And she thought she had dementia or Alzheimer's. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, I just missed the first two letters of every word. Now, she knew she was missing them. And so she would write something down, and I helped her finish whatever it was she wanted to write. But we went to the doctor, and we didn't rush to the doctor, but mentioned it at a doctor's office, and the doctor's eyeballs just lit up and said, oh, we got a different problem, I think. So while she was thinking, and I think this is what happens when we start to have cognitive problems, we think, oh, got Alzheimer's or dementia or whatever. It turned out that she actually had fluid pressure in her brain, and once that was fixed, it didn't go perfect like it should have. You know that 1% that they say something could happen? It happened. But in the end, she recovered. She was able to go back to driving and being independent. But my point being is that we really need to encourage people when they think there's something not right. They don't have to tell the world. I get that this is a scary private thing. But they certainly should be going to their doctors and asking questions, because it might be something that is remediated in an entirely different way, rather than thinking you're just going to get worse and worse, and their damage could be there because it wasn't addressed. So yeah, it becomes a very challenging conversation, but is important to be having, especially with family.
May I respond? I think you're bringing up one of the issues about the data, and there's the responsibility for the person who wonders what's going on to tell somebody, but I think there's a responsibility in the healthcare system to recognize and ask, because patients are reluctant to say, I think I'm having trouble with my memory the same way they might with something else. And so if we had health systems in our state that are much under-diagnosing compared to the best practice, that would suggest that they should be doing some additional training or putting some resources into making sure their clinic systems are willing and able to recognize, and not just if the patient complains, but to look into it to some degree. I think that kind of thing would help when someone like your family member went to the doctor.
Representative Keel?
Yeah, it'd be really quick. I should point out this was in 2001 or two. And so I would say what I'm seeing is doctors are much more readily willing to ask those questions. Medical personnel, nurses are asking. I think we are seeing more of that kind of response, too, to ask questions about what's going on. And the doctor's office is a great place to be respectful and give them the privacy that they need when you're initially exploring that. But yes, we need to make sure our medical professionals do say something.
Thank you, Representative Till. Another reason why we need to protect the pre-existing condition clauses from premiums. Okay, members, so I want to thank the testifiers. Yeah. We look forward to seeing some of those recommendations in bills this year or next year, I hope. And I know we have a couple moving through now, so thank you for bringing the report to our attention and giving us a summary. So, members, I'm going to invite Representative Lippert to the table. He has two bills, so we'll get them in order. They each have an amendment, and I think the amendments were in the 3074 bill packet. And they, let's see, so 3074, Representative Lippert, I'm going to have you, you probably want to put this in shape before we discuss it. So if you want to make a motion to amend House File 3074 with the A20 amendment, you got to put it in front of the committee first.
Yes, so this amendment moves House File 3074 with the author's amendment.
So we need to make a motion to move to place House File 3074 on the general register.
So I'll move that House File 3074 be placed on the general register.
Okay, sounds good. And now you can make your motion to amend.
Okay. I move to amend House File 3074. The author's amendment adjusts the reporting date to January 15th of 2022 and also specifies exactly what is required in the report.
Okay, any questions about the amendment? So Representative Lippert moves the A20-0640 amendment to House File 3074. No discussion on the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, motion is adopted to amend House File 3074. Now to your bill, Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Both of these bills came out of conversations that happened this summer. Congresswoman Angie Craig held a roundtable on Alzheimer's disease in Northfield, the Northfield Hospital, and it was attended by medical professionals, researchers. The Alzheimer's Association was there. Beth McMullen and Mr. Foss was there as well. And as were caregivers, those caring for people with Alzheimer's. And as we listened to one caregiver telling her story, she simply started sobbing before the group. And as she pulled herself together, she explained that caregiving for people with Alzheimer's is extremely taxing physically and emotionally, financially too. And she said there's more that we need to do for caregivers of those with Alzheimer's in our state. And so after that, some conversations started beginning, and these pieces of legislation emerged from that. So House File 3074, in 2017, the legislature established self-directed caregiving grants, caregiver grants to support family caregivers of vulnerable Minnesotans, and appropriated funding for these grants, $334,000 in fiscal year 2020, $477,000 in fiscal year 2021. House File 3074 makes small changes to existing statute to ensure that these funds are made available to family caregivers of vulnerable Minnesotans. Requires the Board on Aging to work with areas aging agencies on aging and caregiver stakeholders in administering the grants. Adds a reporting requirement on grant use and allows all family caregivers of older adults to apply for grants by removing language setting priority access to consumers referred to the program through the senior linkage line. This will make the grants more efficient, more effective, and more accessible to the communities which they are intended to serve. And Josh Nye is here from the Alzheimer's Association as well.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. Would you testify, would you like to introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nye, and I'm the Manager of State Affairs at the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota chapter. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. To be respectful of the committee's time, I'll keep my comments brief and in support of both HF 3074 and HF 3077. You will also hear from a caregiver, Randy Held-Giblin, in just a moment. Thank you, Representative Lippert, for introducing these bills to help family caregivers. Thank you to the bipartisan co-authors for their support and thank you to the Board on Aging for helping to make the language better in both bills. As you heard, there are 97,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's. We estimate this number will reach 120,000 by 2025, an increase of nearly 24%. In Minnesota, there are 255,000 family caregivers of people with Alzheimer's, providing 291 million hours of unpaid care at a value of over $3.6 billion per year. Caring for someone with Alzheimer's can be very intimate and very intrusive, and needs can change as the disease progresses. Almost 78% of caregivers manage household care, including cleaning and cooking, and nearly 48% manage personal care, like feeding or bathing. More than half of all adults providing unpaid care to people living with dementia have been doing so for at least 2 years. One in four provide 20 hours or more of care per week. And one in four are in the sandwich generation, caring for both someone with dementia and another person, usually a child. 14% have reported frequent poor mental or physical health, and nearly 30% have a history of depression. Respite services provide temporary substitute care that gives the caretaker a break. This temporary relief ensures the person living with dementia receives quality care while their caregiver manages and improves their own health. HF 3074 makes small changes to an existing grant program that will get funding assistance to caregivers directly and efficiently. And HF 3077 supports an Alzheimer's-specific respite program in Minnesota. This respite program will ensure family caregivers know that those respite workers or volunteers have been trained to manage challenging behaviors, understand communication abilities, and keep the person with Alzheimer's safe. Both bills bring positive changes that will help family caregivers find time to care for themselves. But we recognize more must be done to support the growing number of people with Alzheimer's and their caregivers, and look forward to working with the committee on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nye. Any questions for the testifier or for the bill author? Okay. Mr. Berg, you have a comment on the fiscal note for this bill?
Madam Chair, members, there is not a fiscal note on this bill. I have communicated with Ms. Benson on the Board on Aging, the affected entity, that at this point I believe the language lines up identically with the Senate file, which is on second reading, and that they do not see costs with this bill. It doesn't affect the underlying grant. It just has a reporting requirement that they're fine with.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Any questions for Mr. Berg on the fiscal note? Well, it looks like we have another testifier on House File 3074. Please introduce yourself for the committee. And
actually,
proceed.
Madam Chair, I believe our testifier will be speaking to 3077.
Okay. So Representative Lippard renews his motion that House File 3074, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Lippard. Now on to the next bill, which is House File 3077, and there is an A20-0639. So first we need a motion to move this bill to Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Lippard.
So I move that House File 3077 be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you. And then to the amendment, A20.
So the A20 amendment.
A motion to
amend House File 3077.
With amendment A20-0639, proceed on the amendment, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the amendment does three things. First, after line 115, it ensures that respite caregivers and volunteers have been provided information, education, and training to provide for people with Alzheimer's disease. So it's ensuring proper training. After line 1.18, it's saying the priority shall be given to those areas where there's a high need for respite services in our state, based on data provided by the Board of Aging. And then in line 2.3, it's again adjusting the reporting date to January 15th, 2023.
Okay, any discussion on the A20-0639 amendment? Okay, all in favor of adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, Motion passes. The House File 3077 has been amended. Now to the original House File 3077 as amended.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3077 has four parts. The first is establishing an Alzheimer's-specific caregiver support program or respite program under the Minnesota Board on Aging. It states that the goal of all area agencies on aging and caregiver support programs is to support family caregivers or persons with Alzheimer's disease or other related dementias who are living in the community by promoting caregiver support programs, providing caregiver support services, and ensuring respite workers and volunteers are trained to care for people living with Alzheimer's. It requires funds allocated to an area agency on aging for caregiver support services to reach family caregivers with Alzheimer's disease or related dementias. Requires funds to be used to provide social, non-medical, community-based services and activities that provide respite for caregivers and social interaction for participants. These grants may be used for individual counseling, organization of support groups, and caregiver training, respite care, and or limited supplemental services. The second part of this bill appropriates $200,000 to the Minnesota Board on Aging and adds that to the DHS base budget. Existing federal funding is awarded to the Minnesota Board on Aging and administered through the area agencies on aging for a range of caregiver support services that is consistent with the National Family Caregiver Support Program. This funding would augment the federal caregiver support funding and specifically target caregivers of persons with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. The $200,000 from the state would be distributed using current processes, so there would be no additional administrative cost to the state. The third part of this bill increases funding per person per month from $400 to $600 for essential community supports under the Minnesota Essential Community Supports Program. And the fourth and final part of this bill, it adds respite care and companion services to the list of essential community supports provided. And with that, I'll turn it over to our testifier today.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Held Giblin. I was a caregiver for my husband, John, who in June 2012 was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease. There were members of his family who had had Alzheimer's through the year, but at age 62, no one had ever had early onset Alzheimer's previously in his family. And to say the least, it came as a shock. When my husband was first diagnosed, he was working full time as a partner in a big law firm. You talk about stigma a few minutes ago. Stigma isn't good. And to be a lawyer with Alzheimer's is devastating. The disease forced him into early retirement. I continued working, but as his disease progressed, he was no longer able to drive. He was no longer able to do much of anything except watch TV, and then only the same channel because he couldn't comprehend how to turn the channel on the remote control. I could no longer bear the thought of his being home alone and worrying about his safety, so I also quit my job. I quit my job and I became a full-time caregiver. I was devoted to my husband. I made sure that every day he was busy. We joined a dementia choir, giving voice. We did meetups through the Alzheimer's Association. There was a program to go to. We went there. It was into clinical trials, anything to do to slow the disease, we did it. We went out to dinner at night. We saw movies. I kept him busy. But unfortunately, the condition deteriorated. And we got to the point where he could not do any more activities by himself. He needed more help. I needed more help. I enrolled him in a day program, which was quite an effort to find the proper day program. And I took him there for the first time on a two-hour trial basis. 2 hours I left him there. 2 hours, it was the first time in years that I had had 2 hours to myself. I specifically recall that day. I specifically recall walking out of the building and exhaling the biggest breath I had had in years, because for 2 full hours, I didn't have that overwhelming burden of guilt and of worry. I was taking good care of my husband, but I wasn't taking good care of myself. I didn't sleep well at night because he'd get up in the middle of the night. He would pace. He'd become aggressive. I didn't eat well. I either ate not at all or I ate too much. I became ill. I developed swollen glands in my neck, and I was diagnosed with metastasized cancer. After further testing and being hospitalized for 5 days, it was determined I had some type of unusual and abnormal bacterial condition, and I was cured with antibiotics. But I want you to know that I attribute my health at that time to the overwhelming stress of being a caregiver. My husband passed away January 30th, 2019. And even though he has passed at the age of 68, there's no day that I don't think what else could I have done for him. I will always be a caregiver. I do know that if I hadn't had some respite for myself, I would never have been able to take care of him. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Giblin. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Thank you for testifying in support of the bill. Okay, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Giblin, for sharing her experience. I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate, as I'm sure the rest of the committee appreciates, you sharing your experience and perspective as a caregiver. I think that Representative Lippert, your bill is phenomenal, and I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I'm sorry for your loss as well. Thank you so much for everything you did to try and to improve your husband's quality of life.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Okay. Do you have any closing comments, Representative Lipper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would simply add that in my work as a pastor, regularly walked with families who are caring for loved ones with dementia, and Ms. Giblin's testimony is consistent with what I've seen with these families too, that we're often, as a community, very concerned about the safety of the person with Alzheimer's dementia, but then also increasingly concerned about the safety and health of the caregiver as well. So I'm pleased that these bills are moving. I think it's a beginning of a conversation about support for caregivers that we need to be having, and I'd urge support for this legislation.
Okay, I forgot to ask if there's any other testifiers here today. Okay, please proceed to the microphone. Introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Mark Hughes, and I'm here on behalf of myself. I lost a stepmother to Alzheimer's, and that was in 2016, but the caregiving went on for about 11 years. 8 of those at my own home, and then we had her in Waverly up in North Oaks, and it went on for another 3.5 years. So what our testifier said today in committee, I feel bad, but that's how it usually works. It's the longest goodbye, and I want our representative to know, if there's any other committees that I can testify in, I'd be glad to help out, because it is just a devastating disease, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Appreciate that testimony. Okay, so Representative Lippert renews his motion that House File 3077, as amended, be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion approved. It's on its way. Thank you, Representative Lippert, for bringing us these excellent bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next week we're going to be talking about elder care issues. So we have 3 bills so far on the agenda. Looking forward to seeing everybody next Monday. And division is adjourned. Thank you.